Thanks for being here. So I hope you brought a Bible with you. And if you would, be ready to open that up in just a moment. This morning, we looked at an episode from the Old Testament in the book of Ezra and also in the book of Haggai, the story of the Jews who returned from captivity in Babylon and the rebuilding of the temple. We saw their failure to get that done initially, as God had instructed them to. And we saw Haggai's motivational speaking to them, trying to encourage them to make God's house their priority. And to make an application to ourselves, we talked about making God's spiritual house, His church, our priority. Our own spiritual welfare and the spiritual welfare of those around us, making that the greatest priority in our lives. Tonight's lesson is one way that that will manifest itself, what we're going to talk about. Jesus said to His disciples on one occasion that He gave them a new commandment. And that commandment, which was really not new in the sense of being something unheard of, was that they love one another. And He said to them, "By this, all men will know that you are My disciples, if you have love for one another." What does that look like? What does that look like in practice? What does it look like when people are seeking to put God's house first in their lives? And one of the ways they do that is by exercising the capacity to love as God teaches us to in Christ. For most of us, 1 Corinthians chapter 13 is probably the passage we would think about in connection with that, at least first. But I don't want to talk about that passage tonight. It's not that it's unimportant, but I want to look at something that Paul says in Romans chapter 12. So be turning there. Romans chapter 12 is a great chapter for many reasons. It's a chapter that I know some Christians have decided to commit to memory because it contains so much good instruction in kind of a compact package. There are a lot of very brief instructions packed into this chapter. We are going to look tonight at the section that begins in verse 9, where Paul begins by saying, "Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love." I want to talk about a couple of the things that Paul says just in those first couple of verses in that section, in verses 9 and the first part of verse 10. He says, "Let love be without hypocrisy." Love, that Paul uses here, is the characteristic word for love that we find so many times in New Testament teachings, the Greek word agape. And you probably are familiar with the fact that the Greeks had a number of different words that might be translated love if you were to render them in English, each with a little bit different shade of meaning applied to different circumstances. They had one word for love between the sexes, romantic or sexual love. They had another word for family love, another word yet for friendship, love between brothers, or love between people who shared a common condition. And sometimes this word agape was a synonym to that third one. Very often it was. Very often those two words were used interchangeably. But in the New Testament, that word agape is used most often in instructing Christians about our attitude toward one another in Christ and our attitude toward all men as well. And it is a word that is emphasizing that our love is to be like God's love toward us. We sang songs tonight, some of which emphasize our desire to be like Jesus. You may remember that we've chosen as a theme to emphasize in many lessons this year, having the mind of Christ from Philippians chapter 2. Trying to imitate Jesus in our thinking and our character. And this love that Paul talks about here and elsewhere is one of the ways we do that. That if we're going to imitate the love that motivated Jesus to become a man and give a sinless life as a sacrifice for sin, it is going to necessarily affect the way we act toward one another, the way we behave, the way we think, What does that look like? Well, Paul gives some examples of that in this very passage. But that love appears in other places as well. Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 22, "Since you have in obedience to the truth purified your souls for a sincere love of the brethren, fervently love one another from the heart." Well, Peter's word sincere literally is the word unhypocritical. And so he is saying the same thing about our love for one another that Paul says here in Romans 12 and verse 9. Let love be without hypocrisy. Paul refers to genuine love in 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 6. There are lots of other passages that emphasize the sincerity of not only our faith toward God, but our love toward one another. Let love be without hypocrisy. Well, what does hypocritical love look like? You ever shown somebody hypocritical love? You probably have. You were nice to them, to their face, maybe said pretty ugly things about them behind their back. You did the very least required to maintain a facade of kindness toward that person while despising them in your heart. There are many ways love might be hypocritical. Paul directs us, Peter directs us, the New Testament directs us to have love without hypocrisy. That's hard. Be devoted to one another, verse 10 says, in brotherly love. That word devoted, or some translations say something like kindly affectioned, is a combination word. It combines two of the other Greek words that are often translated love. One of them is the word storge, which means mutual family love, tenderness, affection is between families. And the other is phileo, the word that is used of brotherly love. And so, doubly, this word emphasizes tenderness. It emphasizes the kind of affection that ought to exist between us as members of a family, not a blood family, but a spiritual family. And then, Paul says, be devoted to one another, or be kindly affectioned to one another in brotherly love. That's the word Philadelphia, love of one's brother. F.W. Farrar's rendering of that verse is, let the love the brethren in the faith as though they were brethren by blood. It emphasizes the family connection that we have as members of God's house, God's household. We talked a little about that this morning. And it emphasized the love, the affection, not just the being nice to people while you can barely tolerate them, but the affection that is meant to exist between us. Let love of the brethren continue, the writer of Hebrews exhorts his audience in chapter 13 and verse 1. Well, what does that look like? How does that manifest itself in day-to-day actions? Some of the things that Paul goes on to talk about in the next several verses are great examples of what it means to love without hypocrisy, what it means to be devoted to one another in brotherly love. So let's just go through these verses for a few minutes and look at what Paul says and consider each point for just a minute. Paul says, be devoted, verse 10, be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Give preference to one another in honor. If you have the old King James Version, it says something like, in honor, preferring one another. I remember having a conversation with somebody who was under the impression that what that meant, what Paul was trying to say, was that we ought to prefer one another as opposed to people out in the world, that I ought to, you know, rather spend time with Scott or Mike or Trevor or Phil because they're Christians than to spend time with my non-Christian friends. Well, as it turns out, I would rather spend time with them, but that's not really Paul's point. Paul's point is to give preference to one another. Honor literally means valuing one another. And it really is the focal word in this phrase. To give preference is literally to lead or to show the way. And so some of our translations have something like outdo one another in showing honor. The idea seems to be that I need to be ready on every occasion to give deference to someone else instead of waiting for them to defer to me. We can find all kinds of applications of that. Not least is when wrongs divide us. When one brother or sister has wronged another in some way, don't we usually want to just decide to be stubborn and force the other person to make the first move toward being reconciled? A week or two ago, we talked about a couple of passages where Jesus instructs us, Matthew chapter 5, again in Matthew chapter 18, that whether we are the offender or the offended, when there is a rift between me and the brother, Jesus places the responsibility on me to take initiative and go seek to be reconciled. That's outdoing one another and showing honor. That's giving preference to one another in honor. Peter writes in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 5, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another. That means that I want to make my brothers and sisters look good. That I want them to experience right treatment. That I put their needs ahead of my own. And speaking of that idea, we go to Philippians chapter 2, a passage we've considered a lot this year because it is the source of the theme that we selected. But in Philippians chapter 2 and verse 3, Paul says, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. That is really just an expanded version of what Paul says in Romans 12 about giving preference to one another in honor. And as the model of that, he holds forth Jesus Christ, who rather than using his status as God as a thing to be used for selfish ends, something to be grasped, he emptied himself and became a servant. That's what I need to do. I need to be willing to serve the needs of others so as to exalt them and lift them up, to give them preference. Jesus gave the disciples a first-hand example of that on the night of what we call the Last Supper. John chapter 13 describes how after supper he got up, girded himself, laid aside his outer garments and girded himself with a towel, grabbed a water basin and started washing the feet of his disciples. Well, that was servant stuff and everybody knew it. Or at the very least, it was an act that a person might extend as a hospitality to people who were honored guests in his home. But very often, if he had servants to do it, then the servants did it. It was a servile act to wash the feet of someone else. I know it sounds strange to us, but in a day and age where people walked pretty much everywhere in very dusty environments, you wanted your feet washed from time to time. It was considered a gesture of hospitality, but more a gesture of service. And Jesus, the master, the one acknowledged as the leader among these men, by far, gets up and takes on the role of a servant. And they were amazed at what he had done. Peter at first was kind of offended by what Jesus did. And Jesus explained to them, if I, your master and teacher, have washed your feet, then you ought to do this for one another. And the point Jesus was making was not about washing feet per se, but about serving one another's needs. That if Jesus was not too important to serve others, neither are you and me. Give preference to one another in honor, Paul says. Well, what else does he say back here in Romans chapter 12? Verse 11. Not lagging behind in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, persevering in tribulation, devoted to prayer. Those are all important concepts, but I want to focus on something that he says in verse 13, contributing to the needs of the saints. That word contributing there is an important one in the New Testament. It is akin to a word that basically means common. It is a verb form of an idea that is often translated in the New Testament, fellowship. It has to do with sharing in a common condition or relationship. But sometimes it is specifically used of contributing to someone's material needs. Sometimes it is used, for example, of monetary giving. The idea is to recognize our sharing in common, our jointly participating in the relationship we have with God in Christ, and that includes our caring for one another's physical circumstances. Bengel said it is acting as if the wants of your fellow Christians were your own. We see numerous examples of that in the Bible. We see it among the very first Christians in Jerusalem in the book of Acts. Look at Acts chapter 4 and verse 32, at what Luke writes about the Christians there. Acts 4 and verse 32 says, "The congregation of those who believed were of one heart and one soul." There's a great description of what it means to love without hypocrisy. And he says, "Not one of them claimed that anything belonging to him was his own, but all things were common to them." And verse 34 says, "There was not a needy person among them. For all who were owners of land or houses would sell them and bring the proceeds of the sales and lay them at the apostles' feet, and they would be distributed as any had need." And it mentions in particular Joseph, a Levite of Cyprian birth, who we know better as Barnabas, a name that means son of encouragement, a name the apostles had given this man. And it describes how he owned a tract of land and sold it and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet so that it could be given to people who had need. Can you imagine taking a piece of real estate that you own, a valuable piece of property, and selling it just so the money that that property was worth could be used to feed or to house or to clothe or otherwise provide for the needs of somebody who was desperately poor? Somebody in this local church. But we see that kind of generosity among the disciples, not just with regard to people in their local fellowship, but also with regard to Christians in other places, sometimes Christians that these people might never have met. Paul encourages the Corinthians about that in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, the instruction that he gives regarding the collection on the first day of the week is against the backdrop of a particular need that had arisen among the saints in Jerusalem, the saints in Judea. They were in desperate need, and Paul was calling on their Gentile brothers and sisters, not just in Corinth, but in many places, to assist them. In 2 Corinthians chapter 9, Paul expands on that a little bit, and he talks about the Macedonian Christians, people in places further north of Corinth, places that we know Paul had preached the gospel, and talks about how they had so badly wanted to help these brothers and sisters, even people that they didn't know. And he encourages the Christians in Achaia, the Christians in Corinth, to be generous likewise. There are more examples of that in the New Testament. That's just one way that we might contribute to the needs of the saints. I mean, these people were literally, as we would put it, contributing to the needs of the saints. Love without hypocrisy looks around it, looks for need, and says, "What can I do to relieve that need?" Looks for people who are carrying heavy burdens and says, "What can I do to help them bear that burden, to help make that load lighter for that person?" I want you to think about the group of people that you're assembled with right now. I'd tell you to look around this room, but I don't want people to feel awkward, people turn around looking at them or anything. But think about the people in this room, and think about the ones that you know are carrying a special burden right now. It may be a health problem. It may be the loss of somebody they love. It may be financial distress. It may be some other kind of problem. They may be having a whole lot of stress and anxiety at work. Maybe they're having family problems. Maybe it's a problem that not everybody knows about, but you do. What can you do to help lighten that load? Sometimes it's hard to think of very much, I know. Sometimes that challenges our creativity a little bit. At the very least, we can pray for such a person. But if we think hard enough, we can probably come up with some way to brighten that person's day, some way to lighten that person's load. That's contributing to the needs of the saints. That's love without hypocrisy. And so is this in verse 13, practicing hospitality. The word hospitality literally means love to strangers. And Paul's word practicing literally is pursuing. And the idea is persistent activity, pursuing hospitality. To be honest, some disciples have shown themselves more inclined to flee hospitality than to pursue it. Because hospitality, well, it's work, it's inconvenience, it's expense. We must be honest. And the excuses that we offer will sound familiar if you listen to this morning's lesson. Well, I don't have time. I don't have the money. I'm too busy. My house is a mess, and I don't have time to clean it up. Or I'm embarrassed for somebody to come in and look at it. In a word, it's not convenient. The greater problem is really not any of those things. It is our reluctance to share our hearts and lives with other people. Because that's really the idea of hospitality. It is more than just inviting somebody into your home, although that's certainly the first thing we think about when we hear that word. And it would have been one of the first things that people thought about in Paul's day when they heard that word. But we're talking about sharing our lives, not just opening our homes, but letting people get to know us on a personal level. Other passages emphasize this idea. In 1 Timothy chapter 3 and Titus chapter 1, both of those passages that outline the qualities a man must possess in order to serve as an elder in the local church. He must be hospitable. 1 Timothy 3 verse 2 and Titus 1 and verse 8. When Paul talks about widows in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and the circumstances under which a widow could be taken into the general care of the church for her provision, in verse 10 he says she must have been hospitable to people. And in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 9, Peter exhorts us, be hospitable to one another without complaint. As each one has received a special gift, employ it in serving one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. One writer said, hospitality is more than bringing someone home and feeding them. It springs from a heart which cares for others, one which renounces reclusive ways and opens itself toward people. But very often that's something we are reluctant to do. And in some congregations, I'm afraid that reluctance has become a hindrance to those congregations really having the kind of unhypocritical love that Paul counsels us to have in this passage, because those people don't know one another very well. In some congregations, what you have is not really a family, not really a group of people who are devoted to one another in brotherly love, but a collection of almost strangers who just happen to meet under the same roof two or three times a week and claim to have a relationship with God and sing about being saved and listen to sermons. But as far as their personal connections with one another, sometimes there's not much there. I don't believe the Plant City congregation is guilty of that for the most part. But we can always do better. And the better we do at hospitality, the more we become aware of one another's needs, the more we become aware of ways that we can serve one another and give preference to one another. And the greater the network of support we will have when we have needs. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 2 says, do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by this some have entertained angels without knowing it. To whom hospitality is to be shown here is not specified. And that reminds me that it's not just my brothers and sisters with whom I need to be willing to share my life and my blessings. What would happen, for instance, if instead of just inviting visitors to come back to services. We invited them into our homes. Or at the very least, invited them to go out with us for a lunch or a dinner. Some Christians do that. I know some of you do that when you have the opportunity. And I think that's commendable. That's getting at what these passages are instructing us to do. How much more would that mean to you if you were visiting at a congregation someplace and instead of just saying, "We hope you'll come back tonight," somebody walked up to you and said, "We hope you'll come have a meal with us this afternoon because we want to get to know you. We want you to get to know us. We want to build bridges of connection. We want to strengthen that bond that we are supposed to have with one another as fellow members of Christ's body." That's part of what it means to love without hypocrisy. And then, verse 14, bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse. And verse 15, rejoice with those who rejoice, and weep with those who weep. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Question. When you see a brother or sister who has enjoyed some great blessing in their life, some kind of success, they got a big promotion or a big raise at work, they were able to buy a larger, better house, they had a celebration in their family, maybe a marriage, or the birth of a child or a grandchild, or some other occasion that brought them great joy that they acknowledged and you would acknowledge was a great blessing from God. How does that make you feel? And does the answer depend on whether you have enjoyed a similar kind of blessing and success yourself? Because when things are going pretty well for us, it's pretty easy, or at least much easier, to rejoice at someone else's joy and blessing. But when we don't feel particularly successful at the moment, when things are kind of difficult in our lives, kind of stressful, and somebody else around us experiences some great joy, what then? Does envy start to creep in? Jealousy? Resentment. I am afraid that has been one of the chief negative effects of social media. And it's been documented. I think there are a lot of great ways that social media is a valuable tool. But one of the problems, and I'm talking about apps like Twitter or Facebook, is that people are usually posting about the wonderful things that are happening in their life. Because we look kind of weird at people who are posting about all the terrible things that are happening in their life. But we'll have friends who are posting, they got to go on this great vacation. Or their child got married. Or they just found out that they're going to become grandparents. Or something else wonderful has happened to them. And we see that and we think, well, that's not happening to me. And we start convincing ourselves it's happening to everybody else but me. And we may start to feel jealousy, resentment. Paul says, rejoice with those who rejoice. And he says, weep with those who weep. The writer of Hebrews in chapter 13 and verse 3 instructed his readers, remember the prisoners as though in prison with them. And those who are ill-treated, since you yourselves also are in the body. I suspect the prisoners he has in mind here are people who had been imprisoned unjustly because of their devotion to the cause of Christ. People who were ill-treated for the same reason. They were weeping. They were going through hardship. And Paul, the writer of Hebrews says, remember those people. Think about those people. Feel sympathy toward those people. Jim McQuiggan wrote that those who haven't cried together have another dimension of love to discover. I have found that to be true. Going through wonderful times together can build bonds of friendship. It can build those bonds of connection that we share in Christ. But you know what really makes those bonds strong and deep? It's It's when we go through pain together. When we go through heartaches together. It's when we are there for one another in times of weeping. And we see the care that is demonstrated. We see unhypocritical love. Our fellowship together means sharing hearts as much as it means sharing anything else. Then Paul says this in verse 16, "Be of the same mind toward one another. Do not be haughty in mind, but associate with the lowly. Do not be wise in your own estimation." This is the last one we'll talk about tonight, but it's so important that I need to think about my attitude toward others. Be of the same mind toward one another. Do not be haughty in mind, but associate with the lowly. That word associate literally means to be carried away, and it suggests a freedom with which I associate with others, that I do not hold myself back from involvement with them. What does that prohibit? It prohibits something, a human tendency that I know comes to us just about as naturally as breathing, and that is the tendency to only associate with people who share our interests in certain ways, and to break up into little cliques and groups. And every congregation of God's people, I don't care who they are, struggles with that. The larger the group, the more of a struggle it becomes. We just naturally gravitate toward people who we find more things in common with. We naturally gravitate toward people who have maybe the same educational background that we do, or are in a similar line of work, or share the same hobbies, or like the same music, or read the same books, or whatever it is. But Paul says, don't let that become something that is a source of division. You love without hypocrisy. We've talked about words for love that are based on a common condition, on sharing something together. What's that common condition in a local church? It is that we are all sinners who have found salvation in Jesus Christ. We are all members of God's family. That's a profound thing to share in common, and it ought to draw us all together, whether we're rich or poor, black or white, whether our first language is English or something else, whether we have a lot of education or a little. You can name all kinds of other things that might cause us to break up into little groups here and there, associating with some people more than others. Paul says, don't be haughty in mind. Don't decide that you are too good to associate with certain brethren because their status is different than yours. Reject the clique mentality. Don't divide along lines of social status or income or education or anything else. Every member of the body of Christ, wrote Burton Kaufman, is a sacred person. Every Christian is the brother of every other Christian. God knows no aristocracy in His holy church except that of loving service. What does love without hypocrisy look like? Well, we've seen a few examples tonight. There are many others that we could consider, many others in this very passage, in fact. But our time's about gone, so we'll stop there and ask one question. When it comes to these applications of the principle of love without hypocrisy, how are we doing? Go home, look in the mirror, and ask that person that you see staring back at you, how am I doing? And how can I do better? Jesus said by this, all men will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. We've seen tonight a few ways that that love should manifest itself. Let's beseech God's help to make us better each and every day in those areas so that we can draw closer together, and more importantly, so that we can show the rest of the world Christ's love living through us. If you haven't done so already, please take your song books and turn to the number Jesse announces our invitation song. We've talked about the love that motivated Jesus to give Himself as a ransom for sin. That's the love we're trying to imitate. When you think about it, that's a mighty tall order. and we are going to do it imperfectly. But we talked about some ways in which, with God's help, we can do that. Well, let's never forget that the ultimate example of that love is Jesus Himself. And you need to understand, if you're not yet a Christian, that that love is extended toward you. Jesus did that not just for somebody else, but for you. He wants you to be His child. He wants you to be part of His family, part of His house, as we discussed this morning. And we hope that you're ready to make that commitment tonight. We hope you're ready tonight, if you believe on Jesus, that you are ready to confess your faith in Him and be baptized in water in the likeness of His death and raised in the likeness of His resurrection and become a whole new person with a whole new family. If you're ready to do that, then we're ready to help you. Make it known while we stand and while we sing together.